Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. Section 5 of William James' essay, The Will to Believe, is entitled Empiricism and Absolutism, and he views these as two different, you might say, intellectual comportments on a global scale that individuals adopt. Now, there are also, you could say, ideal types. It's very rare that you can find somebody who's a pure absolutist, and as we're going to see, empiricists are not always behaving empirically. As a matter of fact, they often behave like absolutists in certain respects, and we could think of a continuum between them. He's also going to contrast them here very briefly to skepticism, so it's worth talking about this contrast at first. He says, "For the purposes of this discussion, we are on what he calls dogmatic ground. Dogmatic ground means that there are some things that you have to accept, you have to believe, in order to make any sort of progress." He says, "Ground which leaves systematic philosophical skepticism altogether out of account." So he's putting that aside. And then he says, well, what is that skepticism? "The postulate that there is truth, and that it is the destiny of our minds to attain it, we are deliberately resolving to make, but the skeptic will not make that." So the skeptic is not just saying, well, there is no truth, or what is truth? The skeptic is also, to some degree, or in some way, calling into question, or even actively denying, our capacity as knowing subjects to know what the truth is. And so, you know, there's varieties of skepticism out there, and we don't have to get into that. Because James says we're primarily interested in this contrast between two dogmatic ways of approaching things, that of the empiricist and that of the absolutist. So then he goes on and he says, "The faith that truth exists and that our minds can find it may be held in two different ways. One of these is the empiricist way, the other is the absolutist way." And he says these are ways of believing in truth, of thinking that there is truth out there. So what's the difference? He says the absolutists say that not only can we attain to knowing truth, but we can know when we have attained to knowing it. While the empiricists think that although we may attain it, we cannot infallibly know when. And you might say, isn't there a bit of confusion here? What do you mean to say that you know the truth, but you don't know that you know the truth? Wouldn't knowing the truth automatically provide its own sort of certitude or its own self-evidence or something like that? And James would say, aha, you're an absolutist. An absolutist of one form or another. So the empiricist says that truth exists, so does the absolutist. Both of them say that we can attain the truth. Where is the vital difference? The empiricist says we can't be sure that we actually have the truth. We can go by probabilities or our best guesses up to this point. Whereas the absolutist says, no, I can know for certain that this is the truth. And so, you know, we might see this as a new version of continental rationalism versus British empiricism. William James has pointed out in other places that the empiricists as a school were often not quite empirical enough, and that there's a lot of rationalism still in there. Be that as it may, let's go on. He says that to know is one thing, to know for certain that we know is another. We can hold the first being possible without the second. So the empiricist is willing to say, yes, we can know things, we just can't always know that we know them. And that's not denying that we can't ever know that we know them, just saying sometimes we have to be unsure. Sometimes we say, I think I know this, but I'm not entirely sure. If you want to call that belief, if you want to call that faith, if you want to call that something other than knowledge as such, go on ahead. That's perfectly fine. So then he says, what these do is show very different degrees of dogmatism in their lives. So it's not just about purely intellectual or theoretical matters, it's also about practical matters as well. And then he says, if we look at the history of opinions, we can see that the empiricist tendency, now notice the term here, has largely prevailed. It doesn't mean that it dominated. It doesn't mean that you can identify it with science. So the empiricist tendency is found in science, where in philosophy, the absolutist tendency has had everything its own way. And then he's got a nice line here, the characteristic sort of happiness which philosophies yield has mainly consisted in the conviction felt by each successive school or system that by it, bottom certitude had been attained. Other philosophies are collections of opinions, mostly false. My philosophy gives standing ground forever. Who does not recognize in this the keynote of every system worthy of its name? So he's saying most philosophers up until his time, and you can't necessarily say this about all philosophers after James or his own mode of philosophy, pragmatism, have been absolutists. Interestingly, even, this is a bit of a side note, the schools that stressed how they were, we could say, empirical or existential or pick whatever you want, and that they were getting away from absolutism, very often as they turned into schools, they became absolutists of their own, didn't they? You can find new versions of dogmatism arising at every point. He uses as an example scholastic orthodoxy. What does he mean by scholastic orthodoxy? He's talking about that of the Middle Ages that we can identify not just with Thomas Aquinas, but also with other medieval thinkers, ranging from, you know, Peter Abelard all the way into Thomas and Bonaventure and some of the scholastics before them, and Scotus and Occam and people along those lines, and then all of their successors going on in Catholic and sometimes, quite frankly, other Protestant institutions. The Lutherans had their own form of scholastic orthodoxy as well, as did the British. So he says, scholastic orthodoxy has beautifully elaborated this absolutist conviction in a doctrine which it calls that of objective evidence. What does this mean? There's some things that we cannot doubt because we just see that they're true. He says, 2 is less than 3, or if all men are mortal, I am mortal too. These illumine my intellect irresistibly. They light up my mind. They have what Descartes would call the natural light shining in on them, right? He says, the certitude it brings involves an aptitudinem ad extorquendum certum assensum on the part of the truth envisaged, and on the side of the subject a quietum in cognitione, which once the subject is mentally received, that leaves no possibility of doubt behind, and in the whole transaction nothing operates but the entitas ipsa of the object and the entitas ipsa of the mind. And he's deliberately using Latin there. He says, we slouchy modern thinkers don't like Latin, but, you know, we've got our own ways of doing things. What do these terms mean? It's basically saying that there is a force that compels an assent on the part of the mind, that we're grasping the thing itself, the entitas ipsa, and we're doing so with the mind itself, and that the mind itself is able to reflect and realize certitude in itself. Right? The quietum in cognitione means a rest in the thought of the thing, a being satisfied with the thing. And so the scholastics are saying, this is the basis for our true judgments that we make, and we can be completely certain about these sorts of things. So that's a form of absolutism. Even modern stuff can be absolutist, though. So he says, our own state of mind is very much like this whenever we uncritically abandon ourselves. You believe in objective evidence, and I do. Of some things we feel that we're certain, we know, and we know that we do know. There's something that gives a click inside of us, a bell that strikes 12 when the hands of our mental clock have swept the dial and meet over the meridian hour. And here James says something that we really ought to take quite seriously. He says that modern empiricists are often absolutists of a different sort, that they're only what he calls empiricists upon reflection. That is, that it requires the active decision of the mind, which means the will is involved, which means our volitional nature, our passional nature is involved, to keep us from falling back into absolutism. He also says that when we're left to our own instincts, particularly when it's things that we would definitely like to believe or things we definitely not like to believe, that we behave as absolutists. We dogmatize, he says, like infallible popes. So he uses as an example of this William Clifford, who says that it's sinful to be Christians on insufficient evidence. Insufficiency is not really what's going on here. Clifford never really entertains the possibility as a live hypothesis that Christianity could have anything to it. There's no possibility of it having any sufficient evidence, so he rejects it out of hand. Now, one thing that James says outside of this section, in the later section about objectivity and certitude, he says that as empiricists, if we give up the doctrine of objective certitude, we don't give up the quest or the hope of truth itself. We still pin our faith on its existence, and we believe that we're actually helping ourselves out. We're attaining, he says, a better position by systematically continuing to roll up experiences and think. And then he says, here's the difference between us empiricists and those absolutists. The strength of the system for the absolutist lies in the principles, the origin, the terminus a quo, the terminus, the end from which it begins. So the starting points. They carry out things, you might say, with a rather sophisticated but rigid way of deductive argumentation or logic. He says, for us, the strength is in the outcome, the upshot, the terminus ad quem, where we arrive. And so really what James is talking about here is not just empiricism. This is also connected with his conception of pragmatism. We see what the results are for our ability to attain truth, truth that we can use, truth that we can live with. And so James doesn't think that we can ever embody completely the empiricist type. We're always going to be lapsing into absolutism here and there. We can't avoid becoming complete absolutists just as much as we can avoid lapsing into a skepticism that won't really allow us to pursue truth. And so empiricism becomes, you might say, something like a middle ground or middle way between those two. Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.